move on to the third case, but I see it'll take a little time to clear here. Legg versus Pappas, 09-1188.
I was afraid this discussion. Keep Brian on his
head. It looked like the run to his tail.
Yeah. Sylvester might know what's on there.
All right. If you're ready, then, Mr. Davis.
Your Honors, Counsel. Although we presented three issues, the first one is the one where I think everything's going to turn, and if it doesn't, then we'll be putting our attention on the third, which is about how summary judgment is being used now by district courts. The first question also really centers around whether you believe the defendant's accounts are the plaintiff's witnesses, Becky Pine and Robert Legg. That by itself, when you look at it, should say summary judgment was inappropriate. We have another kink in this case, and that is that the judge and the defense counsel said and argued that the stories between plaintiff's witnesses and the defendants was only a semantic difference, that they really did not reflect factual differences. Well, I'm going to ask your honors to look at that testimony. It's laid out fairly well in the briefs, I believe. And when you look at that testimony, it's very hard to walk away, especially when you read Defendant AG's testimony, that it does nothing more than reflect really sanitized, self-serving testimony. You know, the most telling about why it is self-serving and sanitized is, in order to make his story acceptable, he even had to make up a fictional character for transporting Walter Legg from the Legg house to the squad car to supposedly lift the man's feet so he would not be dragged in the grass.
The problem here is one of the problems here, and there's several, but it seems to me at the hospital he said he was just fine, he's just drunk, and the doctor, Oakley or something, didn't note any kind of spinal cord problem. And the next day he walked. So it just doesn't look like a case where the police worked this guy over, did anything other than remove a drunk from the house.
Well, and along those lines, too, on the scene, A.G. and Hutt are told that he's drunk, and they look at him, and he's urinated on himself, and he's acting like a drunk. What information are they given that he's anything other than...
Okay, well, the information that he received that he was drunk didn't come from the Meg officers or any members of the family. I believe it came from Walter himself. I believe in my brief I point out that in testimony, Walter Legg has absolutely no memory whatsoever of the entire incident. The strong inference from that, and this inference is supposed to be in our favor, is that his utterances could be looked as the babblings of someone who is unconscious and doesn't know his environment. And so then it becomes a question of what kind of judgment did the officers exercise with respect to Walter Legg. And now there's other evidence that suggests that they should have behaved vastly differently. If you look at the testimony of the Meg officers who were the first on the scene, they described him as passed out, having a blank stare. Now, the information about his medical condition, and this is actually getting on to another issue, but we can go there right now, is that the action that the officers should have taken at that point should have been no action other than to get someone to handle a medical emergency.
His medical condition is extreme intoxication, correct? You're not contending they had the spinal injury prior to Hutt and AG handling him.
Yeah, there's no evidence of a spinal injury prior to...
You're contending that they caused the spinal injury.
Correct.
By the way, they transported him from the house to the car.
Correct. Correct. But it's also our position is that they shouldn't have transported him at all. Because upon finding someone in that medical condition, the step of a trained officer is to... They don't know whether he's had a heart attack, a stroke, in addition to being drunk. There's no denying he smelled of alcohol and he'd urinated on himself and other things. But the fact that he had urinated on himself and others, training says this guy just might have another significant medical problem. In the event that he has another significant...
He had extreme intoxication at that point. That's what they were dealing with.
But they didn't know that. They didn't know that. They had to,
every sign pointed toward that.
I beg your honor. The fact that he was unconscious and had a blank stare and that he had urinated on himself does not point in only one direction to alcohol.
Odor of alcohol, told right. by other officers that he was drunk, mumbling.
Correct. In record you'll see that...
You've got to show some deliberateness, don't you, in order to get anywhere with your case.
Yes.
Deliberate intention to impose the harm or essentially a criminal recklessness, a reckless disregard,
right.
Callous disregard. And where do you get that?
And I'm agreeing on the careless disregard, and that is in the way that they handle him getting out of the house.
Well, what did they do that was different than taking anybody out of a house? Taking a drunk out of the house?
Well, if you look at the accounts and you believe the accounts of Becky
Pine, throw him down a flight of stairs or anything like that?
No, but they rough-handled him down a flight of stairs and across a yard and across rocks. And the language, I used the words as I put in the brief, manhandling. And in fact, Robert Legg says they threw him in the squad, even though it's true that perhaps his testimony can be challenged because he had contradictory testimony. Let's also don't forget, we have a situation here where at least one of our witnesses was also drunk and a drug seller. I can't get away from that. But
how was he quoted? His brother, we're pretty good drinkers.
Correct.
That was an understatement.
Correct. We don't have pretty. I don't have a pretty plaintiff, and I don't have pretty witnesses here.
I guess what you're getting at, though, is when an officer comes up upon a drunk in this kind of condition, which is not unusual. You're saying they need to be transported on a gurney or a board or something of that nature.
Or at least to be medically attended to first. And it's underscored in this case, and I'll tell you why it's underscored in this case, because when they finally got him to jail, the jail wouldn't take him until he had been medically examined.
And what medical attention did, after they got to the hospital, did they do anything to them other than just release him back to the police?
Well, in that particular case, Your Honor, yes, that's what happened. But there's other information to suggest that what happened at that hospital, well, number one, there's some tangible evidence about how he was treated when he reached the hospital. There was uniformly all the testimony before Walter Lake got into the hands of Hutt and AG. There were no abrasions on his face, and there were no marks on his clothing. We get to the hospital. They find an abrasion on his forehead, which coincidentally his treating neurosurgeon said could have caused the spinal contusion, as well as our retained expert said the same thing. But then there are also grass stains on his knees. Now, you recall the defendants denied that they dragged him across the yard and did those kinds of things. I think they protest too much because their stories don't jive with the physical evidence. And I think the inferences from their stories not jiving with the physical evidence should weigh in the favor of the plaintiff, at least to the extent of allowing the plaintiff to have the benefit of a jury to sort out these facts rather than a judge to sort out these facts. And particularly if you take the language of the plaintiff's witnesses, the language is a much rougher treatment than you get from the officers themselves. And if you take the officer's testimony, the position of the judge, I would be justified, but that's not the only thing that's there. I don't know if I fully answered your questions on the matter of the other injury, the spinal cord injury. There's evidence that Walter Legg could walk a little, but without non-movement of his legs, at the beginning of his journey from the Legg house to the squad car. And by AG's own testimony, by the time they got to the squad car, he couldn't move his legs. At the hospital, he couldn't make his move his legs. The doctor there ascribed it to nothing else other than intoxication. However, we have his own treating doctor, who saw him 2 days later, saying, well, look, these kind of symptoms, even if they weren't present at the hospital that night, could show up in hours or days. Our retained expert basically said the same thing. So with a spinal cord injury, it doesn't have to show up immediately, but there's some indication and evidence that it already did show.
What were the warrants, outstanding warrants for?
I believe it was for public urination, Your Honor. I couldn't tell you right now. It was either public urination or possession of drugs.
They probably wouldn't have removed him from the house if it wasn't for the warrants, right?
Yes. When the MEG officers came in, he was cuffed, and that was appropriate. And apparently his identity was determined, and it was found out that he had warrants, and that's why the East Peoria police were called in to then remove him to the Tazewell County Jail and then later to the Peoria County Jail.
Now, what would you have done with warrants out for somebody who's
for public urination
on the floor in this house? Well, is that what it was for?
I believe it was, Your Honor. I can't warrant for sure, but yes, there were other warrants. I did not see that as highly relevant under the circumstances. But he did have other drug charges under other things.
A warrant commands an officer to, once you identify somebody as being wanted on a warrant, you're required to arrest the person and bring them into custody and take them before a magistrate.
Well, and you're right, Your Honor. And one of the first things, you asked me what I would have done. And I'm acting also on the advice of my retained expert, Ken Katsaris, is that, number one, yes, I would have taken him into custody. I got him. He's cuffed, and he is restrained. I have a question about what is his condition. I would want that question answered before I did something, in fact, to harm him. And one of my first responsibilities as an officer is to do no harm, much like a doctor.
Well, that's a doctor.
I know. I said much like, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
You're into your rebuttal time, I want you to know.
Oh, yes, I am. I've got five more minutes later. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jennetton?
Jennetton. Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court, my name is Peter Jennetton. I represent Officer Agee and Sergeant Hutt. The other defendants have been dismissed by the plaintiff for the claims abandoned, so they are the only two remaining defendants. As Your Honors have noted, this is a fairly routine arrest. The officers were called to assist MEG agents. MEG agents asked the East Peoria officers to come in, run a warrant check, and when it came back with warrants, they were asked to transport him to the jail.
Do you recall what the warrants were for?
The one, I believe there were two. I'm not certain of that. One, I'm pretty sure, was for public urination. The other one, I think, might have been for a cannabis possession or something. They were both a relatively minor criminal issues. One of the things that the plaintiff is arguing, in fact, is that there was a medical emergency that the officers were required to respond to. And it's hard to characterize this as an emergency, given that Mr. Legg and his family characterize this as a pretty routine condition for him. This is something that they do pretty regularly. None of his family thought that he needed an ambulance or called for an ambulance or asked for one. Mr. Legg himself did not call for one. The MEG agents who came across him first never called for one, never asked for one to be called, and the East Peoria officers who saw him never called for one. To everyone who was involved, it appeared that he was simply drunk, and they treated him that way. Plaintiff makes a lot of some inconsistencies between Officer Agee's testimony and the other witnesses, and Officer Agee's credibility is simply not at issue. We have to take the version of events most favorable to Mr. Legg, and that includes assuming that his brother Robert is telling the truth. And if you take his brother's testimony, his brother said he was manhandled, and you know they repeated that here. But we asked him specifically what he meant by manhandled and what they meant when they used those terms when they said he was roughed up. They said, well, they grabbed him by his bicep and his wrist, and they, you know, carried him out with his legs dragging behind him and his head bouncing around. That's what they meant by manhandled. So we don't need to resort to the dictionary or to any other terms like that. We know what they meant by that.
And doesn't Robert Legg say that Walter's head hit the rail on the way down the stairs?
In his first deposition, he said, I thought it hit, or it looked like it hit. And I didn't clarify that with him very well. Because some Illinois State Police officers were brought into the case later, we got a second crack at him and went over that with him, and he admitted that he didn't see him strike his head at that point. It's really not a material issue. Even if he did strike his head, a simple negligence or an inadvertent bump is not going to constitute a Fourth Amendment violation. As Your Honor indicated, you know, they never kicked him or beat him. They didn't, you know, work him over at any point. And when he got to Pekin Hospital, Dr. Oakley was very clear that he did not have a spinal cord injury at that time.
In transporting a drunk, the police can't walk him into walls or
certainly not.
Just throw him in, let's say, a paddy wagon and let him bounce around on the way to the...
And there's no evidence that they did any of those things. You know, Robert Legg at one point says, well, they threw him into the car, but then he admits very shortly after that he couldn't see what they were doing. He was just kind of talking about, you know, they carried my brother out and threw him in the car. You know, when we actually asked him what happened and really nailed him down on that, he admitted that he could not see the squad car that they were putting him into and could not see what happened to him at that point. There was a mention by Mr. Davis that some of the doctors indicated that these symptoms can show up hours or even longer after an incident. But both of them were asked about Walter Legg's specific symptoms, and both of them said that if the symptoms were as severe as what Mr. Legg had, they would have been noticed immediately. Dr. Hannigan, let's see if I don't have that site handy, but he said, you know, it would have been apparent. It was hard to miss. I mean, that was the phrase that he used. This would have been hard to miss. When Dr. Hannigan saw him, Walter Legg couldn't lift his arms against gravity. When he was at Pekin Hospital, he was able to move them. So it was clearly a change in condition from when he was at Pekin Hospital to when Dr. Hannigan saw him at OSF.
Is Walter Legg a pretrial detainee at the time they're moving him? They've got a warrant, two warrants.
Correct.
How do we evaluate the standard here? Is it a Fourth Amendment standard? Is it a due process standard?
What is he is a pretrial detainee at that point, and that obviously brings up an interesting question regarding qualified immunity in this case. It is, because of his position at that point, a Fourth Amendment issue. This court made that clear in Lopez versus Chicago in 2006, which was after Walter Legg's arrest, and reiterated that in Williams versus Rodriguez and Size versus Champaign. Prior to 2006, this court applied a deliberate indifference standard in cases like Brownell versus Feigl and Chapman versus Keltner. So it's sort of a textbook application of qualified immunity, where we've got the reasonableness standard under the Fourth Amendment that's the current law, but the deliberate indifference standard that was the law at the time that these officers acted. I don't think the plaintiff can survive under either standard, but it is clear when the qualified immunity context and the deliberate indifference standard comes into play that they were not actually aware of a serious medical need. And without that actual knowledge of a serious medical need, they cannot be deliberately indifferent. Unless Your Honor has any more questions, I'm happy to stand on my brief for the remaining arguments.
I have none.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Davis, your reply. How much time? Three and a half?
And I, too, will try to be even briefer than that. The matter of the routine condition of Walter Legg being drunk in the living room of the Legg house, there's no way that the officers would have known that that was a routine condition when they arrived there, and there's nothing in the record that suggests there was any knowledge on the part of the officers who took him away. So that's a red herring. Next, the language used by Robert Legg regarding how Walter Legg's head was struck on, I believe, the banister of the porch was the word whacked. So it wasn't a matter of being bumped.
But he doesn't say the officers whacked it. He said his head whacked.
I believe you're right, Your Honor, yes.
So he's not, even by the most favorable inference, he's not saying the officers deliberately whacked the head on the
You mean face. Such as in hitting him on purpose? Right. No, there's nothing in the record that would say that.
And you've got to show that kind of...
I understand, but I can also show that their indifference to his own safety with respect to the way his body was moving. His injury came about in one of two ways, and according to the doctors, in most likelihood, either as it was from the blow to the head, and there is evidence that there was a blow to the head. We don't know how that is for sure, but it's there, and it wasn't there before he got to the hospital. And second is either the hyperflexion or hyperextension of the neck, and we have evidence of that in the way he was taken from the house, and there's evidence of his head bouncing around, which would support hyperextension or hyperflexion. And I'd like to make one other point, and that is we've got some inconsistent testimony, particularly on the part of Robert Legg, and if you look at his deposition, you'll also see that on his first deposition, I mean, we have a very hard plaintiff and family to deal with. Robert Legg then told us in that deposition that night before that he and his brother had had another marathon drinking thing. And so by the time that he was giving his testimony, the big inference there is he probably had a very big blood alcohol level. So, but that would be for the jury to sort out about what story he's telling is to be believed or not to be believed. Not for a judge to do. And with that, I'll rest on everything, on my brief for everything else. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, both counsel, thank you very much, and we'll take it under advisement.